This is the Quality News Network. Evacuations of Americans have begun in Lebanon, where at least 27 more Lebanese have been killed in Israeli attacks on this, the sixth day of the Israeli bombardment. Lebanon says more than 175 of its citizens have now died and more than 400 have been wounded since the fighting broke out last Wednesday in response to the kidnapping by Hezbollah of two Israeli soldiers. A commercial liner, the Orient Queen, is heading for Lebanon, escorted by a U.S. destroyer to begin evacuating Americans to Cyprus. Military helicopters are also being used. The plans were stepped up today when it became known that Israel is allowing evacuation ships through its blockade of Lebanon. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and British Prime Minister Tony Blair have called for an international force to be sent to Lebanon, an idea supported by Russia and the European Union, but opposed by Israel and President Bush, who maintains that a better solution would be for Syria to put pressure on Hezbollah. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says the Israeli offensive will continue until the two captured soldiers are returned and Lebanese army troops control all of southern Lebanon. In Israel, two people hurt today in a new rocket attack on the city of Haifa, where eight people were killed yesterday. In Iraq, another U.S. soldier has been killed in western Baghdad, the fourth since Saturday, and at least 48 people killed today by explosions and gunmen in a market in Mamadiyah, south of Baghdad. Dozens more were wounded. In Indonesia, as many as 70 people have been killed, with another 70 missing following today's six-foot tsunami triggered by its 7.2 earthquake, which hit the island of Java. A perfect landing at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida for the Discovery Space Shuttle, ending a successful 13-day mission. The U.S. Senate today begins debate on a controversial bill to increase funding for embryonic stem cell research. It passed the House a year ago. If now passed by the Senate, President Bush is promising a veto. The 62,000-acre wildfire in Southern California, which has destroyed 58 homes, is now 70% contained, and firefighters are continuing to make progress in battling an adjoining blaze of 15,000 acres. A dozen major U.S. cities across the country are sweltering through record-breaking heat waves. Temperatures exceeding 100 degrees are expected to sweep through the Northeast today. And in Mexico, where an official winner of July 2nd's presidential election still has not been declared, leftist candidate Andrés Miguel López Obrador led nearly a million marchers through Mexico City yesterday, demanding a full recount in the disputed election, which apparently was won by his conservative opponent, Felipe Calderón. This is the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
IBM has been awarded a $17 million government contract to provide the Defense Department with instant messaging, web conferencing, text chat, and other services. McDonald's has announced its second quarter profit rose 60%, thanks largely to World Cup sales, promotions connected to Disney's release of the movie Cars, and the introduction of, in the U.S., of its new Asian salads. Another record for the Disney film Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, which earned $62.2 million in its second weekend, raising its 10-day total to $258 million, making it already the top-grossing film of the year. Citigroup, the world's largest bank, says its second quarter profit rose 4%, helped by growth in corporate and investment banking, but that was less than Wall Street analysts had expected. General Motors Board of Directors is meeting today to discuss a potential alliance with Renault and Nissan. This follows a meeting on Friday in Detroit between the company's CEOs. Load Air Cargo, a recently launched air freight operation based in Kuwait, has signed an order with Boeing for delivery of two 747-400 extended-range freighters, a deal worth $494 million. And Mattel is showing a second-quarter profit due in large part to its summer entertainment toy lines based on Cars and Superman Returns. Light sweet crude oil is trading at $75.70 a barrel this hour, down $1.26. Wall Street is mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials up 10, NASDAQ is up 1, and the S&P 500 is down 1. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. When Prime Minister Ehud Olmert became Prime Minister of Israel after Ariel Sharon's death, he was elected on a platform to withdraw entirely from the Gaza Strip. Not only that, but to give away large swaths of the West Bank, which Israel had occupied since it was attacked in 1967, to the Palestinians to form a Palestinian state. And he was going to do it without any negotiations. The Palestinians, of course, refused to negotiate with him for anything less than the complete annihilation of Israel. They did not want to negotiate. They refused to call off their attacks. But he was going to give it to them anyway. And when he did, the Israeli right, well, they went apoplectic. They were arguing, you idiot. Don't you know that Hezbollah and Hamas, that these are terrorist organizations, they will never stop. They will never stop until Israel is annihilated. They will cross internationally recognized boundaries. They will attack. And when you retreat before them, you simply encourage them to attack. But the Israeli left and middle stood firm and said, no, we want to withdraw from Gaza and Lebanon, but to do so not for the reasons you think, not because we're naive enough to think we don't have enemies, but because by withdrawing we can achieve consensus within Israel and within the world that does not understand that these organizations will continue to attack Israel. Well, now the Israeli right is saying, I told you so. I told you so. You never should have left Gaza. You never should have left Lebanon to treat the Palestinians humanely. To give them a state of their own, to give them a legally recognized boundary was an idiotic mistake because it showed them weakness and they would attack. But I defend the Israeli left. I defend Ehud Olmert, the prime minister. I believe and continue to believe to this day that the withdrawal from Gaza was a good thing. Prior to the withdrawal from Gaza, there were people out there who legitimately thought that Hamas, the democratically elected government of the new nation of Palestine, would treat Israel with peace. There were articles, you remember those articles in the United States press, far more in the European press, that suggested that the fact that Hamas said that Israel had no right to exist, the fact that they called for the annihilation of Israel, the fact that they wanted to throw all the Jews in the sea, that was just rhetoric. They didn't mean it. Give them a country on their own, let them start governing and worrying about governing, and they were going to leave Israel alone. What Prime Minister Olmert said was not that I believe that Hamas will leave us alone. I know they will continue to attack us. Anyone familiar with Israeli history knows Israel from 1948 to 1967 had no part of the West Bank or Gaza, and yet they were attacked. They had a peaceful border with Lebanon until the Arab government installed Hezbollah, particularly Iran, installed Hezbollah in there, and they were attacked. Any Israeli, most Israelis, knew that just because it was an internationally recognized boundary, just because Israel was holding back and allowing the Palestinians to rule themselves, they knew the Palestinians would attack. But the world didn't know. They didn't know until just this week. And there were some Israelis that didn't know. They weren't sure whether perhaps it was the occupation that was causing all the resentment. And now that Israel removed, ended the occupation, and Hamas still attacked, and not just Hamas, but the democratically elected government of Palestine declared war and attacked Israel. Remember, Hamas is not some terrorist organization in Gaza. It is the democratically elected government. 77% of Palestinians supported declaring war on Israel. 16% were opposed, and I do feel for that 1 in 6 Palestinians that did not want war with Israel. But they attacked anyway. And I still think the Israeli left was right. I think they were right because I think at this point the world understands, or should understand, that when the Palestinians refuse to take yes for an answer, when they refuse the many, many offers of Israel to give them a state, whether in Camp David in 2000, whether in negotiations before and after, they refuse to let Israel exist while Israel is trying to help them exist. It is truly an unequal situation. But now I think people can see, not just in Israel, but around the world, that In this case, there's no question of international law. When a country is attacked, you can look at the Geneva Conventions, you can look at the United Nations, you can look at the law on war. When a country is attacked, it has the right to defend itself. So what was going on in Lebanon? Well, I think you know. We were pressing Iran and pressing them hard. We were convening the entire United Nations together, convening European nations, the G8, to press Iran to give up its nuclear weapons. There was no reason why it needed nuclear weapons. No country had said that Iran had no right to exist. No country was dedicated to the annihilation of Iran, to the murder of all of its people. Iran did not need nuclear weapons, but they were developing them anyway. So what did they do? Very clever. I have to admit, very clever on their part. They took their proxies, Hezbollah, which they control in southern Lebanon, and said, attack Israel. Rain missiles on its cities. Kidnap its soldiers. Do so that the world focuses on Israel and not on Iran. It's a very clever, so they thought, idea. And it may well turn out to be, but I don't think so. Precisely because Israel is entirely acting in self-defense, precisely because they have withdrawn from Lebanon and Gaza, I think the world is seeing they have a legitimate right to self-defense. And it's an interesting thing. The Israeli right said that Hezbollah and Hamas would take the Israeli withdrawals and say they are weak. To this day, the Hezbollah leader, Nasrallah, in Lebanon says, I kicked Israel out of Lebanon. And he's gotten a lot of power because of it. And the Israeli right says, see, that's why we were an idiot to leave. Again, I think the left was right. I think the left was correct. Better for Israel to leave. Better to have a United Nations Security Council resolution on the books, which already exists, which says that the Lebanese government has to take control of the country of Lebanon. They are required under international law to disarm Hezbollah. And they haven't done it. And so clearly on international law grounds, Israel is solid. When other countries attack internationally across internationally recognized boundaries into your country, you have a right to self-defense. And the Lebanese government is violating international law by not controlling the terrorists within its borders. Now, what's interesting to me is I've gotten a lot of comments in email and on the blog. And by the way, folks, feel free to comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Or you're always welcome to call in, agree or disagree, at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Or if you just want to talk amongst yourselves during my radio program, you're always welcome to do that at headonradionetwork.com. Just go into the chat room and say whatever you like. I won't be listening to your chat room. But I have heard some complaints about people who seem to see the two sides as equivalent. And I have to admit, I find that troubling. There are people around the world, no question, who see, for example, Al-Qaeda's attack on us and our attack on Al-Qaeda as equivalent. I don't think they are. Al-Qaeda attacked us, they murdered 3,000 Americans, and we went in with a vengeance. And we conquered not just Al-Qaeda, but the Taliban. And some would say, well, wait a minute, you know, why didn't you just go in there and selectively try to shoot down Al-Qaeda members? Why did you have to conquer all of Afghanistan? But I think most Americans understood the Taliban was supporting Al-Qaeda. It was the government itself, in essence, that attacked us. When you have a government that supports a terrorist group on its territory, there is no distinguishing between the government and the terrorist group. And so I respond to Jeffrey, who wrote me, and I won't give his last name because he didn't give me permission to do that. But when he writes me that, you know, terrorists are not necessarily the government, he couldn't be more wrong. In the case of Al-Qaeda, we know the Taliban supported Al-Qaeda. George Bush, one of the things he did that I supported, demanded that the Taliban turn over Al-Qaeda to Americans, that they themselves root out Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban said no, and we declared war in Afghanistan. Now, that's, of course, very different from the war in Iraq, where we attacked first. We did a preemptive strike. Iraq never attacked us. That war had no justification under international law. But our war against Afghanistan did. And the same is true with Israel. The government of Hamas was elected by the Palestinians, who firmly support their declaration of war on Israel. So, when a country declares war on you, you have the right to respond with war. Again, international law, law of war, it's all the same. And the same is true with Lebanon. The Lebanese government may not have wanted Hezbollah to attack Israel. I suspect they didn't. But the Lebanese government, by violating international law, by not taking steps to comply with Security Council Resolution 1559 and to root out and disarm the Hezbollah terrorists, when they allowed their state to be used to attack, then obviously Israel has a right of self-defense. And my hope is that eventually the way out of this crisis, if there is one, is for Israel to join with Lebanon and work with Lebanon to root out and disarm Hezbollah. And as soon as the Lebanese government says it's going to follow international law and root out Hezbollah and is willing to work with Israel to do that, then of course Israel should stop its attacks immediately. And I'm hopeful that will happen. Of course, the downside is this may draw into Syria and Iran. And yet, sometimes war is necessary. And it may end up to be the only way to actually remove the nuclear weapons of Iran. If you agree, if you disagree, I encourage you to call in 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275, or you can comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Guy James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Michael Franti from Spearhead talks about the new benefit CD for the nonprofit environmental law firm, Earth Justice.
I'm always involved in Earth Justice as an idea, no matter where I go.
Franti, along with artists Nora Jones, Los Lobos, Willie Nelson, and Bonnie Raitt, donated their music in support of life's absolute necessities, clean air and water.
Music today is not speaking to really what's happening on the streets. It's really important that artists come together, work on projects together, and put out unified voices about what's happening today in our planet.
In the United States alone, more than 70,000 people die per year from air pollution. Music makes a difference. Give it a spin at wherewelive.org. That's Planet Check.
Planet Check is possible thanks to Clif Bar, the energy bar made with organic ingredients by a company committed to sustaining you and the planet. More at cliffbar.com.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It is the Sunday Weekly Review. Any and all topics you want to talk about are fine with me. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Later on in the broadcast, I want to talk about the Lieberman-Lamont Democratic primary in Connecticut and why I support Ned Lamont, and also talk about the decision of the highest court of appeals in New York against allowing gay people to marry, and why I think that in time, democratically, gay people will win the right to marry at the ballot box. But any other topic you want to discuss, again, it's 888-488-MARK. If you want to talk about the Middle East, obviously, I'm definitely into that. And I think it's the most interesting part of the news today, because to me, this is a clear war. This is like responding to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. This is not like Iraq, where we attacked a country that never attacked us. Israel has an absolute right to do what it's doing. And frankly, I wish George Bush would not call for them to be restrained. How would we feel after September 11th if people asked that we be restrained? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not calling on Israel to kill civilians, to purposely kill civilians. Certainly, I do not want to do that. No country should do that in war. We should not do that in Iraq, although we have killed tens of thousands, nor in Afghanistan. No country should ever intentionally attack civilians. But the question is, what do you do when you have a country, or a terrorist group that is hiding behind its own civilians? What do you do, and I gave this analogy in some correspondence with a listener of mine, and I'll be reading that correspondence to you in just a minute, but as I asked Jeffrey, what do you do if a man starts to kill your children, one by one by one, and you have a gun, and you can shoot that man, but he's holding his own child in front of his chest as a barrier? It's a horrible choice. Do you shoot back at the man and risk killing his child? Or do you watch slowly and helplessly as he kills your children one by one? And I responded, you know what? You have to fight back. And you have to try to avoid hitting his child. You have to try to hit the man even though he's shielding himself with his own child. And if you should happen to kill his child, as much as you tried not to, then you sigh and you talk about the horrible man who would sacrifice his own child's life while trying to kill yours. It's an awful, awful choice. But it's not the fault of Israel that Hamas puts its fighters in hospitals, in ambulances, in apartment buildings, that they shoot from civilian areas. In fact, I have to give Israel a lot of credit. What they're doing now, before they're attacking, is they're dropping leaflets. I don't know of any other country in war that's done this. I don't know if the United States did this. I don't think so. But Israel's actually dropping leaflets warning people, you live near Hamas terrorists. Get out. The bombing will begin soon. And warning people to get out. Now, does this help Israel in the war? Absolutely not. Of course it doesn't help. We're going to bomb here is perhaps the worst war tactic ever. Study any war. Study our own, Revolutionary War, Civil War. The element of surprise is crucial. In fact, many wars are only won by the element of surprise. Israel is giving up that element of surprise to try to protect not its own citizens, who are getting missiles raining down on their head. Their third largest city, Haifa, is getting missiles raining down on its head, not to protect its own citizens, but to protect Lebanese citizens, to protect Palestinian citizens. They're saying, get out, we have to bomb. And meanwhile, of course, the terrorists get out too. So Israel doesn't kill anyone. They just destroy some infrastructure, which is good. But to me, that's showing an amazing concern for civilians and perhaps a little too much. I don't know. Particularly in the case of Gaza, where the citizens themselves support the war. Now, my listener Jeffrey disagrees with me. I want to read to you what he wrote. He writes, well, Mark, I'm disappointed in you. I listened to you talk and transformed temporarily into Sean Hannity. Jeffrey, that's a real insult. You know that. When you talked about war, so fervently cheering for the bombing of civilian targets, so fiercely proclaiming that those people need to suffer more if they don't see our side. Well, now, wait a minute, Jeffrey. I didn't fervently cheer for the bombing of civilian targets. I definitely do not cheer for any intentional bombing of civilians, and I don't think anyone thinks Israel's doing that. I do, however, cheer for some bombing of targets that serve both needs, including bombing that, yes, hurts civilians, though doesn't kill them. And the clearest example, the electricity grid. I firmly believe that we won the war in Bosnia because we attacked their electricity. My candidate for president, the guy I supported, was General Wesley Clark. I still think he is a terrific guy. He would be a terrific president. I heard him speak just the other night and was saddened to think that he was not our president and this bumbling idiot George W. Bush was. But Wesley Clark had it exactly right. How did he stop the genocide going on in Kosovo? He didn't send in U.S. troops to occupy the country, as Bush stupidly did in Iraq, making them sitting targets. We did not lose a single American in the Kosovo War. Not a single life. Kind of amazing when you compare back to the 2,000-plus that are dead in Iraq. What did he do? He made the Serbian citizens who chose their government change their mind. Change their mind. The Serbian citizens, those that supported the government, supported the genocide going on in Kosovo. And what did he do? He knocked out the electricity grid in the capital of Serbia, Belgrade. He made people not get electricity. That's right. They may not be able to get heat in the winter or air conditioning in the summer. And it's not a pleasant thing. It's not a pleasant thing. But that's how you win wars, folks. Look at any of the wars in history, you see that siege is often the way to win wars. I think, frankly, knocking out electricity is far less than doing things that are traditionally done in wartime, which is deny food and so forth. Yes, when you have citizens and civilians supporting a war, you've got to hurt them enough that they don't want the war to continue. That's exactly right. I'm not saying go after civilian targets in the sense that you go after killing civilians, but going after civilian targets like industry and electricity, absolutely. That's how wars are fought. And I you know, it's hard enough to fight a war with a hand behind your back when Israel, for example, follows the Geneva Conventions. The United States does not. We may now, and that's in fact an interesting topic for conversation, whether or not George Bush will actually follow the Geneva Conventions after the Supreme Court decision in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. But Israel follows the Geneva Conventions. Its prisoners of war are looked into by the Red Cross. And for the people that would suggest that the Israeli soldiers kidnapped by Hezbollah and Hamas are somehow similar to the Palestinians and the Hezbollah terrorists in Israeli jails, think again. Let me just give you a concrete example. This is one of the prisoners that Hezbollah demands should be freed in return for returning the Israeli soldiers that it kidnapped across an international border. His name is Samir Kuntar. He was a PLO guy in 1979. He also went into Israel, into the Israeli town of Nahariya, not a town in the West Bank. It's a beautiful town, actually, on the coast. Broke into an apartment building, took the father and the child hostage, murdered the child by striking the child's head against a rock, and then killing his father. Israel didn't execute him, though we might the United States. Israel put him in jail. Well, Samir Kuntar is a hero among the Palestinians. He's a role model for Palestinian children. His pictures shine throughout the territories, throughout Hezbollah areas of Lebanon. Your child should grow up so that it learns to bash children's heads against rocks. Your child should grow up to be a murderer. That's their hero, and they want him returned in return for Israeli soldiers. Well, here's the difference, folks. Samir Kuntar got a trial, was convicted, is in jail, is able to be accessed by the Red Cross. The Israeli soldier, we don't know where he is or they are. Certainly the Red Cross isn't allowed to visit them. Certainly they don't follow Geneva Accords. It is wrong to somehow assume that these are the same. And yet Jeffrey, and I like Jeffrey, Jeffrey and I agree on a lot of political issues. We both are not big fans of this president. But Jeffrey writes, both sides are foaming at the mouth, and both sides are so absolutely right, and the other side is so absolutely wrong, and anything one side does is absolutely right, while anything the other side does is absolutely wrong. Jeffrey, look, you know, I don't support those on the Israeli right. I actually supported those on the left that said leave Gaza. But there's a difference between a country like Israel that's willing to allow the Palestinians a state and the Palestinians who refuse to allow Israel to exist. When someone is fighting for your existence, there's no argument over borders. There's no argument over tactics. If a guy is trying to kill me and the only way for me to prevent him is to kill him first, I have to do that. And to not do that, to show weakness, I think leads to more war. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. You can comment on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. You can talk in the chat room at HeadOnRadio.com/chat. We'll be right back after this.
Head On with Bob Kincaid.
Let's go back to the phones, and we are joined by Beauregard T. Clampett, I'm told, on line one.
Hi there, Bob.
Well, Mr. Clampett, how are you, sir?
That's fine, sir. You all have had a ruckus on the airwaves this evening, Bob, and I just got to tell you where I fall down on this subject.
And fall down you do, I suppose.
So you catch on quick, I tell you. You're very quick, very quick. But I did want to just, because I kept hearing things like amnesty, and I've had to tell you, Bob, if we have amnesty, we can't work them to death like we're doing. We can't pay them $3 an hour if we let them become citizens now, can we?
That whole 13th Amendment thing's still a thorn in your side, isn't it?
We won't talk about that either, Bob. Now, we're working on repealing that sucker, but it's going to take a while.
Catch Bob Kincaid weeknights, 7 to 10 p.m., right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Good man underground.
Head On. Hi, my name is Aaron, and I'm a survivor of mannequinism. Mannequinism is basically when you turn into a hard plastic shell. They say it's from not being politically active. For me, it started when I didn't register to vote, and then I stopped volunteering, and before I knew it, I wasn't doing anything. And that's when I found the first sign. A small, discolored, hard patch of plastic on my right shoulder. I thought it would go away on its own, but it didn't. It kept spreading. And when I could no longer conceal it with a t-shirt, I knew I had to see the doctor. He said I had this early stage of mannequinism and that my only hope was to get involved, even if it was something simple. So I began reading the newspaper and instantly got feeling back in my arm. I guess you could say I'm living proof you can fight mannequinism.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Janine Marks, a 12-year-old, was fairly normal. She spent a lot of time online. One day, she met a new friend. The new friend had the same problems at home. They liked the same bands. They worried about the same subjects in school. They promised to keep each other's secrets. They wished they went to the same junior high. The new friend had good news. He said he was going to be in Janine's area one Saturday. He thought it would be amazing if they could just hang out, go to the mall. Janine agreed. The new friend didn't want parents messing this up. Janine showed up alone. So did her new friend, who wasn't in junior high, wasn't nice, and wasn't a 14-year-old boy. Last year, one in five children was sexually solicited online. Help delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is the Weekly Review. All topics are valid. I've mostly been talking about the war in the Middle East, which may end up expanding, folks. It may. Syria and Iran are definitely behind this. And I don't know. I'm afraid that there may be a time for war. But someone who may disagree with me, I'm not sure, is Gordon from Michigan. Gordon, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. You know, I'm trying to get a handle on the prognosis of what's going to go on here in the Middle East. Like you said, there's a good chance it's going to escalate because you say, well, Israel has a good right to go into Lebanon, and now, as ground troops from Israel go into Lebanon, so Syria has just an equal right to go into Lebanon, too, reestablish their troops there, and that can't be a good thing. And like you said, where do the ties of Hezbollah really go? Do they go all the way to Iran, too, and does Iran...
Absolutely. Yes. Iran has been funding Hezbollah for some 30 years now. In fact, it's interesting because, in essence, all of these terrorist groups trace their funding back to the United States' use of oil. Every time you fill up your SUV, just remember you're giving funding to a country like Iran that gives its money to terrorists like Hezbollah. So, yes, Iran has been funding Hezbollah for a very long time.
So I'm thinking if Syria becomes an active antagonist in this, what are the possibilities of Iran actually mobilizing ground troops? And where do the major powers line up then? Now, Russia and China don't want to necessarily burn any bridges with Iran. And, of course, the U.S. and an economic and European Union are going to fall on the side of Israel. And if things get out of hand, who is to say that U.S. or European Union forces don't have to go in there?
Well, you know, I don't think we're going to end up in World War III. I do think this war may escalate, and I think Syria and Iran may get involved. One of the things I find very interesting is that the other Arab countries, with the exception of Syria and Iran, really are very quiet. Countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan and countries like, even like Libya or countries that you would think would normally jump to the Arab cause. And what's interesting is I think because Israel withdrew from Lebanon and from Gaza, and because under international law it's very clear, whereas before it wasn't so clear, but it's very clear that Israel is acting in self-defense, I think the Sunni Arab countries are concerned about Iran and Syria too, because Iran, of course, they're not Arabs, but they're Persians and they're Shiite Muslims. And Syria is, though a majority Sunni country, its dictatorship is controlled by a Shiite sect, the Alawite sect, and they're concerned as well. And my hope is that Lebanon, which is a weak government, no question, but is a government where the country is really split. It's very interesting. If you read the news reports, you see, for example, Christian Lebanese praising Israel bombing Lebanon because they want to get rid of Hezbollah, this whole private army in their country, while at the same time is the Shiite Muslims in Lebanon are, of course, defending Hezbollah. And Israel's being cautious in the sense that it's striking the Shiite Muslim areas, but it's generally leaving the Christian areas alone. Now, you know, it's sometimes hard to tell. But my hope is that because there's already a Security Council resolution that says that Lebanon has to take over its country, that Israel can work with the Lebanese government, the new Lebanese government, the one not controlled by the Syrians, to work together to disarm Hezbollah. Now, maybe I'm just dreaming, but you're absolutely right that it does have a possibility of extending to Syria and to Iran. I don't think it'll go further. I can't see Russia or China actually defending Iran in war. I don't see that happening.
Well, what the danger would be if Israel actually is threatened to be overtaken by many different countries, and the U.S. would be forced to defend Israel. If Israel falters, that would be, I think, the major problem. If Israel is successful, they have the capability to show restraint, and that would be probably the way to avoid further conflict. But I think if Israel falters, if all of these other countries that aren't showing their cards right now, if they decide to fall in line, or if Syria somehow gets some kind of an upper hand, and Israel has to retreat. And
Gordon, I don't think that's a concern, at least not at this point. Israel is definitely militarily stronger than Hamas or Hezbollah. Now, they certainly have the power to rain missiles and to kill Israeli citizens, but they still don't have the power to occupy Israeli territory. And the Syrian army, although it could definitely pose a danger, is not as powerful as the Israeli army. Now, Iran is a very powerful country, but of course Iran does not border the region. It can't go through Iraq, certainly. You know, it doesn't have nuclear weapons yet. So I don't really see Israel faltering. They could lose a lot of lives. You do that in war. It's a pretty awful thought. But I that doesn't concern me. One of the interesting things that actually came out of the G8 meeting was the idea that the international community would send troops to southern Lebanon. And that may be the right answer, to let the UN disarm Hezbollah. After all, Hezbollah, there's already a UN resolution saying that Lebanon's a sovereign country and you can't have this private army there. That resolution dates back to 2004. So that may well be the answer. But I do think that it's, I mean, I think that this may actually turn out to be a decent thing. I know, Gordon, you particularly are talking about Department of Peace, and certainly peace is always the preferable solution. But I think there is a time for war, and if Iran were to get involved, then I think Israel could do a nice little tactical strike against their nuclear plant, as they did in Iraq in 1982, and might just end the Iranian nuclear power threat. We won't end it, but we'll postpone it for a number of years. So it may turn out okay. I don't know. It's tough.
Well, I think that is the positive side of this, is that there is the possibility for Israel to posture, like you said, posture for a better position to negotiate a stronger peace. That's the positive side of this. And that's practicably where I put my cards. I don't see Israel faltering either. But like I said, if there is that other option possible in war, war is always the unpredictable.
Right.
There are things you can't, you can try to talk about the past, but the future is the future, and that's still a mystery. And
no, I think you're right. I mean, war is war, and it's always to be a danger. But I'm heartened by, and I admit I'm reading between the lines, and I mean, you know, I read the newspaper today, and I see there are two types of Lebanese. And half the people quoted are saying, you know, Hezbollah is not our government. They are in the government, but they are not the government of Lebanon. They are a player in the government, but the majority is not Hezbollah. And they have no right to declare war on Israel without the permission of the Lebanese government. How dare they? We were just rebuilding Beirut. We were just getting the city back. And now Hezbollah has put us into all of this, and I hope Israel destroys them. And that's mostly from the Christian community, but to some extent from the Sunni Muslim community as well. And then you have these very poor areas by Shiite Muslims, and they're cheering in the streets and saying, I don't care how much destruction happens, you know, and I'm willing to die for this cause. And so I don't know which will win the day. In essence, they're, you know, it's leading to almost another Lebanese civil war. It's kind of the same thing in Gaza. In Gaza, you see fewer examples, but I did read one again in the Post today about a woman with 10 children who said, you know, why did they have to shoot those missiles into Israel? I wish that Hamas would just leave them alone so I can sit and raise my family. She's the minority view. The majority view, of course, is fight to the death. But sometimes I think, you know, I don't know, I don't believe we ever would have stopped Nazi Germany if we had not totally demolished Germany, and or Japan for that matter. I think those things were necessary. I do think that you should try, you hope that that's never required, ever. But when you have people saying, I'll fight to the death, sometimes you have to show them dead. I'll tell you, Gordon, I was just recently out in Virginia, visiting a bunch of Civil War sites, and it was very interesting to me. I went to Manassas and was studying the First Battle of Manassas. And in that battle, you had Union soldiers who had never seen war, and you had Confederate soldiers who'd never seen war. And both of them thought it would be easy, and both of them thought that the war would be over in a matter of months. And you had actually both Northerners and Southerners sitting on hills, women in their petticoats, watching the gruesome battle down below. And after they had a taste of war and a taste of destruction and vicious, vicious bloodshed, both sides went away with a new understanding that war was not going to be easy. And sometimes I think that all this, you know, Israel, please show restraint, that's just not the right answer, because if they show restraint and people think that war is easy, they're just going to continue to lob missiles into Israel, which no sovereign state would allow. So I actually think Israel shouldn't, I mean, obviously they shouldn't try to kill civilians, but at the same time, they shouldn't try to show too much restraint either. They need to know that war is war.
Well,
go ahead, I'll give you the last word.
Well, there's a point where you can actually attack a mysterious force of Hezbollah, which is not necessarily a nation state, which can move in and out of different areas. there's a point where invading Lebanon, they're going to reach a point of diminishing returns where they're not going to be able to actually get the Hezbollah. So,
well, I agree with you, Gordon. I'm not supporting an Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I think, again, looking at the United States, the difference between the way we fought Kosovo, we didn't let up. It was entirely an air campaign, but we didn't let up, and we kept going until the Serbs withdrew. But we included things like attacking factories and attacking electrical grids, and we tried to avoid hitting civilians. We didn't always succeed, but we tried to. That's very different. And of course, it was a justified war. But that's very different, I think, from occupying a country, which Israel did and didn't really succeed, because it's much harder, as we learned in Iraq, to occupy a country than to make life miserable enough so that the country stops waging an aggressive war. So I agree with you. I don't think Israel should reoccupy Lebanon, but I do think it should continue bombing until the Lebanese government joins with Israel in fighting Hezbollah.
But,
anything
know,
last to say?
And there's a point where it just becomes punitive onto the civilians. And, you know, when you get there, you start killing other nationals of other countries. I think of whether they already killed 8 Canadians or something like that.
Yeah, well, I don't think Israel obviously intentionally did that, but they should do their best to avoid that, no question about it. There were some Lebanese-Canadian nationals, yes, that were killed.
And what are the limited prospects for U.S.? What can Bush really do now?
I think what Bush can do is work with the Europeans to put, actually, I would support sending limited troops in there with the support of both Israel and the Lebanese government. I think you need both that support before we do anything. And work with Israel and Lebanon and the international community to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1559 and to disarm Hezbollah. Apart from that, I think all that Bush can do is sit back and say to Israel, you know, try not to hit civilian targets, but you have a right to defend yourself in war. And so that's about all we can do. I mean, the problem is, of course, is all of our troops are stuck in Iraq in a hopeless war. And so it's very hard for us to threaten anything. I mean, certainly Ronald Reagan tried to send Marines to Beirut in 1982 and got them bombed, and we ran away screaming. So it's a tough situation.
Well, you know, I think if the U.S. troops were the buffer forces between Israel and what other forces are in Lebanon, I think that would cause Israel to assume a different...
Well, Israel would stop immediately if that were to happen.
Yeah.
And the question is whether Hezbollah and Iran behind it would risk shooting U.S. troops as that buffer. And they might. And that might draw the U.S. into
and
a larger war.
Of an escalation.
Gordon, we've got to take a break. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Johnson's. We're not available to take your call. If you're calling about the apartment for rent, please leave your name and number after the beep, and someone will get back to you.
Hi, my name is Sanjay Rana. I would like to make an appointment to see the apartment.
Oh, hi, this is Robin DiPaola, and I'm calling about the apartment. Please give me a call back at 2.
Hi, hello. This is Rafael Baeris. Please call me back at 718.
This is Jeannie Chu. I'd like to talk to you about the apartment. If you can please call me back.
Hello, my name's Clayton Anderson. I'm calling about the ad in the Sunday paper.
Oh, hello. This is Mrs. Johnson. You must be calling about the apartment.
I am. Is it still available?
Well, you're the first person to call about it. Are you available?
Housing discrimination of all kinds is illegal in the U.S. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
Ready?
Not.
Ready?
Not.
Your body's been ready for quite some time.
Not.
Ready?
But not your mind.
Ready?
Not.
Ready?
No way.
You have lots to do before you have a baby. But don't forget to take folic acid today and every day to prevent birth defects one special day. So when all of you is ready, that baby of yours will be ready to take on the world.
Ready?
Not.
Ready.
The Native American Journalists Association is calling out to tomorrow's reporters, photographers, editors, and publishers to represent Native perspectives.
Today's agreement allows the Nebraska State Patrol and Winnebago Tribal Police to share enforcement.
The tribe is taking its concerns to the Bureau of Reclamation, which manages and
Native American inmates have filed suit against the prison.
Go to NAJA.com to learn more about membership and benefits. NAJA, raising the next generation of storytellers.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Interesting primaries. It's coming up in August in Connecticut, where you have Ned Lamont taking on veteran Senator Joe Lieberman. Now, all of us know who Joe Lieberman is. He, of course, was the vice presidential candidate in 2000. In fact, he was the man legitimately elected vice president of the United States in 2000 with Al Gore as president. And he's seen as, and I think quite rightly so, on the righter edge of the Democratic Party as a conservative Democrat, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. On domestic policy, I largely agree with Lieberman. I think he's wrong on a few issues, notably the faith-based initiative and so forth. But I couldn't disagree with him more on U.S. foreign policy. And Democrats in Connecticut are upset that Lieberman is being so supportive of the Bush administration. Lieberman, to his discredit, has said that if he loses the Democratic primary to Ned Lamont, who is virtually unknown, he's a former Greenwich, Connecticut city councilman, that he will run as an independent. Way to go, way to be loyal to the Democratic Party, Joe Lieberman. But the real problem, I think, with Joe Lieberman is the arguments he's making about support of George Bush, which fall right into the arguments of Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter and all the like. He's saying, in effect, that Democrats should not condemn George Bush in a time of war. He's saying, in effect, and I don't want to so much pick on Lieberman because this isn't a quote from him, but I will quote from someone with the Democratic Leadership Council, which is the moderate to right-wing Democratic group that supported Bill Clinton and Al Gore, but also supports Joe Lieberman. This is a quote from Stephen J. Nider. He writes, quote, "Far too many Democrats view George W. Bush as a greater threat to the nation than Osama bin Laden," unquote. Well, Mr. Nider, let me be clear. I view George Bush as a greater threat to the United States than Osama bin Laden. What? What? Am I crazy? No, wait. Listen to what I said. George Bush is a greater threat to the United States than Osama bin Laden. Does that mean Bush is as evil as bin Laden? No. Does that mean Bush murdered 3,000 Americans? No. Bin Laden is more evil than Bush. Bin Laden, yes, if he had the power to, would do far more damage to the United States than George Bush. But that's the point. If he had the power to. Bin Laden doesn't have near the power George Bush does. He's holding up in a cave somewhere, you know, planning to do evil things to the American people, no question. But George Bush actually is doing horrible things to the American people. He's dismantling our Constitution. He's saying that America is a country that tortures. He's saying we don't have to follow international law. He's saying I don't have to follow the law to spy on Americans. He's doing more damage to America than Bin Laden is doing right now. So George Bush is a greater threat. And what Joe Lieberman needs to understand is that you don't be quiet and just back up and support your president in wartime. If you're going to be the loyal opposition, you have to oppose when you think the president is wrong. So I hope Ned Lamont does beat Joe Lieberman in the primary. If Joe Lieberman wins, yes, I, of course, will support him against a Republican. We can do a lot worse than Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman is not, Ted Stevens of Alaska. He's not McConnell of Kentucky. I mean, there's some really awful Republicans out there. No, but we can do better as a Democrat, and that's why I hope that Ned Lamont will win the primary. I also want to talk about the New York decision of the highest court in New York. In New York, the highest court, for some silly reason, is not called the Supreme Court. It's called the Court of Appeals. In New York, the Supreme Court is the lowest court. Hey, don't ask me why. I'm not a New York lawyer. But the highest court in the state of New York said, with some really silly rhetoric, that gay people in New York don't have the right to marry. They said, in effect, that their constitution, which protects equal rights under the law, it doesn't protect gay people because there can be a rational reason, the New York court said. You can rationally believe a child is better raised under a man and a woman. What the New York court didn't explain is how we get from here to there. If a child is better raised by a man and a woman, what does that have to do with the right of gay people to marry? If two gay people get married, are you arguing that straight people will marry less? Are you arguing, in effect, that millions of straight people want to marry gay people? All you married straight men out there, you want to be gay, but the only reason you're not is because we don't allow gay marriage? And yet that's the logic of the argument. It makes no sense. And we should never have a vote on civil rights. Civil rights should be equal protection under the law. A majority cannot and should not be able to discriminate against a minority. But I find some hopeful things in that decision. The hopeful things I find is that the democratic policies of states are starting to embrace equality for gay people. In New York, a wonderful man, one who I hope to see run for president someday, Elliot Spitzer, the attorney general, who's running for governor, supports the right of gay people to marry. In California, the legislature, both House and Senate, voted to allow gay people the equal right to marry. It's true that Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it, but I think it's coming, folks, and I think it's coming sooner than blacks in the civil rights movement, and I'll tell you why. In the civil rights movement, whites had something to lose. Now, I know you think that may be an awful thing to say, but giving blacks equal rights, okay, meant that for some white people, they'd have more competition. They wouldn't have easy jobs that blacks weren't allowed to. And, yes, there was all kinds of problems in the inner city and busing and so forth. There was some reason, and I don't think it was justified, but there was some reason for white people to be scared about black equal rights. They were wrong. But there's absolutely no reason for straight people to be scared about gay people marrying. Unless you believe that your husband or wife is a closet homosexual, there is nothing a straight couple has to fear about giving gay people equal rights. And that's why I'm very proud that if you look at young Americans,